You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.
Hello, and welcome to SpyCast from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Peter Ernest, the executive director of the museum. I served for some 36 years in the Central Intelligence Agency, largely as what is called an operations officer or a case officer. Every month, we'll be bringing you interesting talks with visitors, with authors, and with others who have something to do with the world of intelligence and espionage. My guest today is Judge William Webster, a gentleman with a very distinguished career in Washington, having been the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation as well as the director of the Central Intelligence Agency at a time when I was very pleased to work with him. And since then, he has continued to be involved in public affairs, and he is currently a member of the Department of Homeland Security Advisory Council. And he has had to deal with some of the very vexing issues which face that new Department of Government as it seeks to reinforce both our domestic security and take other measures in the face of disasters such as Katrina. Let me ask you, Judge Webster, given your background, if you had an opportunity, and certainly it's possible that you might, had an opportunity to brief, let's say, the new occupant of the White House, possibly his national security advisor, are there any things that come readily to your mind that you feel are important that the president take into consideration or address as he begins his tenure as president?
Well, there are probably so many of those that I would forget to name the most important ones, but one would hope that as there will be a change of administration, there will be a new president, regardless of which party prevails, that person understands the correct role, both of national security as such and of intelligence gathering, to support the policy decisions that are made elsewhere, but for which the president will be responsible. I think that it's important that he understand that the intelligence community, and there are several agencies, and especially the CIA, whose responsibility is to gather useful and timely information to be helpful in making the best policy decisions, and that they bring no policy motivations to the table. And if he has any doubt about that, or she has any doubt about whoever the president may be, that ought to be addressed, because I believe that otherwise there will always be the latent suspicion that the head of that agency is trying to promote a policy by giving only the information that supports the policy. Likewise, I think it's going to be the responsibility of the person who has responsibility of telling the president what is happening in his world, to be sure that the intelligence that he gives is not dissected or cherry-picked to supply information to support a policy that has already been made or a view of the world that has already been formed.
Do you, as you look at the intelligence community today, which is now some 16 agencies, including the newly formed Department of Homeland Security, do you have the sense that it's working out along the lines that the members of the 9/11 Commission had intended when they asked for the formation of, when they asked for reform within the community and the creation of the Director of National Intelligence, a brand new office?
Peter, I'm not at all sure that this meets the expectations of the 9/11 Commission or the people who support it, or perhaps even of the congressmen who voted for the legislation that followed it. That's not a criticism of the leadership. I think that the appointments to head the Department of National, to be Director of National Intelligence have been excellent. I think the appointments to head the CIA have been excellent. That's really not the issue. The issue, I think, stems from the fact that there was enormous pressure brought to bear following the issuance of the commission report to enact appropriate legislation before we had another terrible and tragic terrorist event. And that pressure or panic prevented, in my view, the Congress from coming to the kind of legislation that the commission itself advocated. I'll be very specific about the three things that I thought were most important if we were going to shift from having a director of central intelligence, which I thought could work with the proper legislative authority, to a new director of national intelligence. First of these being budgetary control of the intelligence community. You look through 200 pages of that bill and you find very little about his actual authority. When I was director of Central Intelligence, I knew that I lacked the authority that I needed, but I tried to make up for it by acting as a kind of den chief who tried to build consensus among the and consent among the intelligence community members. I don't think we made much progress beyond that situation in the legislation. The two other things that I felt we should have provided for were some role for the Director of National Intelligence in the selection of the heads of the various, the 14, 15 members of the intelligence community, which the DCI never had and which I hoped that the newly created office would have. And finally, and as an outgrowth of that, I felt it was important that the Director of National Intelligence have peer review responsibilities, which he does not. Heads of the various heads of the different components of the intelligence community, largely military, still report to someone else. And they are always respectful and polite to the Director of National Intelligence, but I suspect that they salute another place, which makes it difficult to achieve the ends, I think, of the 9/11 Commission. Those three things are missing. And finally, the thing that concerns me the most, I suppose, in terms of management, is that instead of developing a kind of joint intelligence committee, such as the British have used successfully over the years, of a small group, say 30 to 50 at the most, but say 30, that extra layer has evolved into something exceeding, I believe, 2,000 people now. Certainly it passed 1,500, and I think it's probably over 2,000 now. It's hard for me to imagine what those people could be doing to advance the interests of the president and those responsible for national security in terms of an overlay on people who already have the assignments. And I fear, I'm giving it all to you now, but I fear that unless it's carefully brought under control, there are going to be people out there who are doing precisely what the Director of National Intelligence has said he does not want to do, and that is to get into the operations of the different organizations. And I continue to hear reports that there are tasking going on at that level of an operational nature, which would be confusing to anyone trying to know who he reports to and who he takes orders from. So I'm hopeful that in due course, the new president will direct the right people to take a look at the way the structure is evolving and whether or not it needs correction and redirection, as I think it does. And I say that without criticism of the leadership, because I think the leadership is excellent. The leadership has to deal with the authority they've been given, and at the levels that they've been given, and try to have a system that is efficient, not confusing, and responsive.
Well, I think you put it very well, and I think that was certainly a major concern of the professionals, was that they understood why there might be a new office to oversee the community, but the concern being that it not be simply another layer of bureaucracy and perhaps end up doing some of the very things that you've just mentioned.
Exactly.
I wonder if I could just turn to something. I think the organization of the community and the points that you've made are very valid, but I'd like to just turn to sort of something that we hear a lot about Main Street today, and we
sure.
hear a lot about
we sure do.
What concerns the people. And I think one of the things that has been a subject of concern in people who think about intelligence, or they think about the kinds of conflicts that we're having to deal with now, insurgency and so forth, and they think about the issue, and I'll call it civil liberties, the civil liberties and national security. That's always been a balancing act. It's as old as the Republic. But we're now in a new phase of the Republic, in a sense. And you have not just been head of these two agencies, both of which deal with those issues in some of their work, both the FBI and the CIA. But now you're on the advisory council of the Department of Homeland Security. And I think that's one of the issues you've had to grapple with in that position. And I just wonder if there's some comments you could share with us today on that issue.
Well, as you point out, it's as old as the Republic. In fact, the issue is older than the Republic by my calculations. I think it was first articulated by Sir Edmund Burke almost 300 years ago in Bristol, England, when he said the kind of liberty he meant is one accompanied by order, and one that not only could not exist without it, but it was liberty protects order, order protects liberty. And the balancing that's necessary there can sometimes be very complicated. The public in general, and the American people in general, are not always of the same mind and on all occasions, so it's a different type of circumstance. We had a deputy director of Central Intelligence named Vernon Walters. General Walters was one of Eisenhower's trusted advisors, ambassador to the United Nations and to Bonn, and he'd thought a lot about these issues, and he wrote that the American people are ambivalent about intelligence. When they feel threatened, they want a lot of it. And when they don't feel threatened, they think it may be just a little bit immoral. Well, I've thought about that a lot, because it tends to affect the attitude of people on specific issues at specific times. And decisions can be made that are later regretted because they are extreme in an effort under pressure to obtain the information that people feel are vital to prevent some other incident from taking place. And we went through that period now, but it's come into play in terms of executive orders and other authorizations that have to do with how far you can go when you have a person you believe has information that's vital to our national security in getting that information. Logically, you'd like to think that by talking to them and interviewing them and so forth, that you could get the information. And, of course, it doesn't always work that way. And the next step is how much physical or psychological pressure can you bring to bear in order to get the information? And the counterpoint of that issue is that we find that those of us who have worked with the business of getting information, that is, the reliability goes down the more extreme the measures. The more pain you inflict on someone, the more likely you are to tell you whatever you want to hear or they think you want to hear just so you will stop the pain. And we call that the issue of detention and interrogation when you have taken someone in custody. And there are a lot of constitutional issues that we can't have time to discuss here fully that go to the question of under what circumstances can you take a person in custody. You know, if you're in a war and they're in uniform, they become a prisoner of war and they become subject to articles of war that are understood and clearly understood. When, as we had in 9/11, we've got a new type of category of a person who is not loyal to a particular flag, serves no particular state, not in uniform, and serving their own particular purpose. What kinds of responsibilities do you have to these illegal combatants, as they are sometimes called? And we're still thrashing that one out, it seems to me. But we know that insofar as possible that we ought to follow the Geneva Conventions, which deal with the humanitarian treatment of people taken into custody. I'm not talking about how long they can be kept, but how they should be treated while you have them in your custody and control. And then there are some who feel that these extreme measures maybe should be entrusted to an agency such as the CIA. That's not altogether welcome, because people who do this work and who serve in the CIA do not want the reputation for engaging in activity that is an extreme, pain-provoking, I'm using as an example of that sort of thing, sleep deprivation and so forth, been known to police officers for years. But the extreme measures, the CIA is not a Gestapo, does not want the reputation for doing that. And besides, as I said before, how reliable is the information obtained under those circumstances? So we're still searching for reliable, less intrusive means of getting information. Everyone wants to get there before the next bomb goes off, and that's vitally important. The FBI has been changing dramatically its efforts to participate in intelligence gathering, rather than simply investigating a crime that's already occurred. I think it's not correct to say that this is something new, because I recall when I was director of the FBI, I first went to it in 1978, we were experiencing 100 terrorist incidents a year. They were lethal. They were not like the Trade Center or the bombing of the Pentagon, but they were lethal, and they needed to be addressed. And the only way to address is to reduce those numbers was to get there first. And the only way to get there first is to have the intelligence. So they have been working on that issue, although less effectively than they would like, particularly with respect to converting their data gathering, their data mining capabilities, to know what do we know about something when we get a clue that something's happening. They were so constricted in the days when the balance wheel had shifted away from getting the information more to protecting civil liberties, and two searching reports called the Church Committee and the Pike Committee reports in the early 1970s pretty much dictated that the FBI should work differently, separately, in a different location and in a different way than the CIA. And the CIA should be overseas and not in the United States, and that limited the level of cooperation. So getting to be more effective depends again upon how necessary is the information and how reliable is the information that is going to be obtained, and how true to our values are the methods that we use. And that is a part that I think we have to keep reminding ourselves, that we do not want to let these terrorists turn us into them.
Okay. I think it's a valid point. It's a dialogue that is still going on.
Yes.
One that you are participating in. You know, it occurs to me as we're speaking here that having heard you testify on the Hill, you've had the distinction and pleasure or dubious pleasure of appearing a number of times in front of the Hill leadership, but particularly of the oversight committees. I'm sure it's something you've given thought to, But would you see a virtue in there being a joint oversight committee overseeing, say, CIA and perhaps even in the FBI?
Well, yes, I do. I mean, just as a matter of efficiency, we've recently been going through some tough economic times, and we've seen the two houses of the Congress not functioning well together. And I think that the kind of information that is shared could be shared under more controlled situations. They would not be going off in different directions. We've had joint committees before. We've had a joint economic committee. We've had others. So I see it. I don't say it's absolutely necessary, but I see a real advantage to working in that way. I don't know whether the American people realize that we have currently two special committees, one in the House, one in the Senate, in which they are select committees, carefully selected, and each hold their hearings in very secure quarters, very tightly held information, and they are entitled to know anything roughly anything that's in the possession of the intelligence community. That makes them surrogates for the rest of the Congress and the American people, because they cannot go out and begin to throw out information that might endanger other people's lives or give away the progress that we made in getting to the source of some serious terrorist threat.
Well, we are so subject to sort of blogging and rumors and sort of underground conspiratorial type thinking. Let me just ask you, as an American citizen, because Congress does stand as surrogates for us, and the committee in turn stands as surrogates for the rest of Congress, are you satisfied that the oversight process in the main, we know there'll be flaws here, but in the main, works?
I would have to say that I believe it is. This would not to say it can't be improved, but I believe it can work. One of the ingredients that we haven't talked about that I think is absolutely essential are two issues, which I call truth and trust. And I say they are the oil and the grease that makes it possible to share information, have that information protected, and have the oversight done in a proper way. If trust is lacking, if the surrogates do not believe they are being told the truth in the testimony that's provided and the information that's given, they'll act in a different way, and that way will not necessarily be good for the country. So it's important that the manner in which testimony is given, it makes clear that the witnesses or the people who are sent to represent the community and the executive branch are giving answers which are truthful, that they are complete. I used to use what I call the four C's, that all testimony must be correct, candid, complete, and consistent. And when we started that process, the accusations that we were being disingenuous and lying and withholding information really went away. But truth builds trust, and without trust, we're all in deep trouble.
Well, I remember those, even these many years later, I remember that you felt so strongly about that we'd be absolutely upfront and level with the Congress, and that was the way to ensure that the process worked, and I remember that after the years.
I'm glad you do remember. I really felt I was right, but I also felt there would be times when people would look around in one of those so-called secure rooms and see 20 or more gargoyles of people who were not clearly part of the official party, been brought in or allowed to be present, and the sensitive questions that were being asked, and they felt uncomfortable in trying to answer them. That the solution was simply to say they weren't authorized to answer the question in that setting, that they would go back and the agency would work with congressional staff to serve their purpose and also protect our duty to preserve and protect sources and methods. And so I'd encourage them not to be cute, to avoid an answer. If they shouldn't answer, tell them not. They'd answer later when the setting was proper.
Okay. Judge Webster, it's been a pleasure to have you here today, and I hope your thinking and some of your concerns make their way to that first occupant of the White House when he goes into the Oval Office. And thank you again for being with us.
It's a pleasure, Peter. Thank you.
Well, we look forward to continuing this dialogue with you, and we'd like to know if you have any comments or questions on today's SpyCast. You can get in touch with us through email at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org.